Welcome, all of you. I've seen a number of you earlier today, but for those who I didn't see, I'm Lauren LeRoy. I'm the president and CEO of Grantmakers in Health, and I'm very pleased to see all of you here today. Before we get started, I've got a couple thank yous that are important to make. I want to first thank the California Wellness Foundation for providing support for this session, and also the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation for webcasting the program so that those who couldn't be with us today will have access to this session. Every year, as many of you know, at the Fall Forum, we invite in colleagues from the policy community to join us for a program that speaks to the shared interests of health grant makers and those who are working to inform and shape health policy. For example, last year we focused on Mayor Bloomberg's Poverty Commission and strategies for combating poverty in New York City and the intersection between poverty and health. The year before that, the topic was the Massachusetts health reform. And every 4 years, our topic is predetermined. Everybody wants to talk about the implications of the election for health and health care. The endless speculation, particularly for those in Washington, around cabinet appointments, schools for Sasha and Malia, whether the first dog will be a mutt, how many millions will be coming to the inauguration, and what proposals will make it into the first 100 days, this is all very entertaining. But we all know that what transpires in this critical transition period and the years beyond is very serious business, particularly in the current economic climate. So we've gathered together this very authoritative crew of distinguished veterans of moments like this. Veteran doesn't mean old, it just means experienced, to help us think through what the implications of the election are likely to be, both nationally and in all the states and communities that you work in. Chairing the panel is Jackie Judd, a longtime broadcast journalist who is currently the vice president and senior advisor for communications at the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation. And I'm going to hand it over to Jackie and enjoy the show.
Thank you very much. I wanted to thank Lauren for inviting me back. I moderated the same panel 4 years ago. And 4 years ago, none of us could have imagined the economic or the political climate that we would all be returning to 4 years later. So this will be an interesting time and an interesting discussion. I'll introduce our panelists from my left to right, Mary Agnes Carey, who is a longtime healthcare journalist. She's the associate editor of Congressional Quarterly's Health Beat, and she has covered healthcare issues for almost a decade, or a little longer, for CQ. Norm Ornstein, if you watch TV, you know Norm. He's on all the time. And his perspective is that, of course, of an election analyst and a keen observer, a longtime observer of the political process. Norm is the resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a columnist for Roll Call, and an election analyst for CBS News. To my right, an old friend. We traveled together on a political campaign decades ago. Sam Fulwood, who is a national political writer with a Midwestern perspective. Sam comes to us fresh from working for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and just moved to Washington a few days ago. So welcome, Sam, on many levels.
Thank you.
Sam was the national political writer, is now the national political writer for TheRoot.com, which offers commentary from the black perspective. And he was a longtime reporter with many newspapers, including, as I said, the Plain Dealer, the LA Times, and the Baltimore Sun. And finally, Bob Blendon, a good friend of Kaiser's, an opinion researcher and political analyst. He is the professor of health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health and the Kennedy School of Government, and is the co-director of the Kaiser Washington Post Survey Project. We are going to start with brief comments from each of our panelists, their view of the implications of this election. I'll follow up with some questions and then open it up to all of you. So, Mary Agnes, if you can get us started.
Okay. Can people hear me from this mic? Yes? Nope.
Yeah.
How about this? Is it better? Okay. It's been a busy week on Capitol Hill for healthcare, and I hope to give you some of the latest developments and also take the issue forward for you looking into next year. Obviously, it's going to be huge. You know, incoming President Barack Obama made healthcare a centerpiece of his campaign, and polls will show, and have shown rather, that voters are really concerned about the cost and the quality of their healthcare, and I think in this economic downturn, they're also worried about losing their healthcare. It's a huge economic issue, and when you view it in that way, which Senate Democrats are doing and House Democrats as well, I think it brings a real urgency to the issue. Everyone's expecting Congress to move next year early on with a large economic stimulus package, and they're making the case on Capitol Hill now that you've got to make health care part of that. For example, yesterday I covered a Senate finance hearing where Max Baucus, the whole theme of it was health care is an economic issue. He said you can't have economic recovery without health care, and several other Democratic members of the panel made that issue, made that case as well. So I really expect to see that next year. Speaking of Max Baucus, who heads the Finance Committee, he unveiled last week a very sweeping health care proposal. It has a lot of elements very similar to Barack Obama's plan. He would offer a menu of health plans to uninsured individuals and small businesses to help them provide coverage. He would require employers, with some exceptions for small businesses, to provide coverage. He would make subsidies available to low-income uninsured Americans. He would allow a buy-in to Medicare for ages 55 to 64. He made it clear yesterday he wants to build upon the employer-based system. So they're sending the messages to reassure folks. You probably remember back to the Clinton health care debate. There was a big concern that I was going to lose my health care. They're trying to be very clear now that you can keep what you have, but if you don't have insurance, they want to help you get insurance and keep insurance. Another big player in the Senate, of course, is Edward Kennedy. He's head of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. Yesterday, the Finance Committee and the Help Committee met together to talk about health care. Senator Kennedy has announced a group of lieutenants. Names will be very familiar to you. These are Help Committee members who will work on health reform. They include Hillary Clinton, Tom Harkin, Barbara Mikulski. After the meeting yesterday, they came out and told reporters they want to move on health care right away before Congress gets too occupied with other things. And they also had some Republicans in that meeting. They had Charles Grassley, who's the ranking Republican on the Finance Committee. They had Mike Enzi, who's the ranking Republican on the Help Committee. They had Orrin Hatch there. They've been very clear in the Senate. They want to have a strong bipartisan support for a bill. Even with the increased Democratic majority, they don't have that magic number of 60, which stops the filibuster. So it behooves them to reach out early and often to Republicans and get consensus that they build this plan. Healthcare is a big deal in the House as well. Pete Stark, who heads the Ways and Means Health Subcommittee, has had hearings on this issue. One of his first priorities is to move on reauthorizing the state children's health insurance program, or SCHIP. He also wants to take a look at the Medicare physician payment system. Henry Waxman, who this morning won the support of his caucus to chair the House Energy and Commerce Committee next year, healthcare has been a big issue for him always, and he's had several hearings at House Government Reform to look at Medicare and other healthcare programs, so he's got tons of experience. Tom Daschle at HHS is another very strong signal that Democrats are going to make this a priority. He's the former Senate Majority Leader. He's written a book about health care. He's got a lot of ideas. So I think all the stars, if you will, are aligning to have a focus on health care next year. There's two key questions in my mind as I try to evaluate legislation and the potential for passage or failure, and they relate to timing and money. Okay? We had a $700 billion bailout for the financial industry. With the ongoing deficit issue, we're talking about $1 trillion of a deficit. You've got ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Is it going to leave any money for health care, right? Of course, if you talk about it as an economic issue, there are many lawmakers who say that the imperative is that if you can provide money for the financial industry, you've got to do it for health care. It's critical, as we talked about, to the economic overhaul, and that if you invest now in things like comparative effectiveness or healthcare information technology, yes, it's going to have some upfront investment, but it will pay for itself over the next 10 years. But as you may know, Congress operates on something called PAYGO, pay-as-you-go rules.
Hold it close.
Closer. Okay, sorry. Sorry about that. If you didn't hear me, I'll start over. No, I'm kidding. Anyway, they operate on this thing called pay-as-you-go rules, right? PAYGO. And Republicans are very concerned about a growing deficit. Some conservative Democrats in the House called the Blue Dogs are worried about it. So how will that interact with this zest, if you will, to spend more money on health care next year? When Senator Grassley came out of the meeting yesterday between the Health Committee and the Finance Committee, he said that PAYGO, for a lot of us, PAYGO is a big issue. So that is a clue that Democrats are going to have a fight on their hand if they try to spend more or significant amounts more, I believe, on health care. And there's also other congressional spending priorities they have to look at next year. There's funding for NIH. There's funding for HHS and CMS, as well as the SCHIP reauthorization. And next December, we're looking at this Medicare payment physician issue again. As you may know, there's a formula how Medicare pays its physicians, and they keep running into these problems where physicians face a huge cut and Congress steps in to fix it. They're going to have to do the same thing again next December, and that's going to be a pressure point, I think. So how will Congress respond? We have to look at the economic stimulus package. Will that be where they go? Would lawmakers look at that to make, if you will, a down payment on health care? Would they focus on areas of consensus, health information technology, comparative effectiveness, more money on prevention, expanding SCHIP in some way to cover more of the uninsured? How will they look at this idea of, do they do smaller bills or a larger bill? After the Clinton health plan, the feeling on Capitol Hill has been smaller is better, larger is not where we want to go, but will we see a departure in that next year? Pressure points apply, again, looking at the SCHIP reauthorization. That is supposed to happen by the end of March. Of course, with consensus and votes, you could extend that and continue that dialogue on SCHIP, and could it be a vehicle for broader health reform? I'm not sure if that is the answer. Will the Medicare physician payment issue, which has to be resolved by the end of next December, could that be a vehicle for health care reform? I think these are all pressure points to watch. Now, on the idea of paying for it, there's been a lot of discussion about how we pay private plans in Medicare called Medicare Advantage. If you equalize those payments with the traditional Medicare program, you can get some money. Also, there's been some discussion about evaluating how the tax treatment of employer-provided health insurance. And so looking at that exclusion provides hundreds of billions of dollars in financing as well. So I think those are two critical pay-fors, if you will, looking at health reform as we move ahead to next year.
Thank you. Norm?
I thought this was working, but it's not. First, a little breaking news. There actually is news about the dog. Of course, you know that they need a hypoallergenic dog. They've picked an all-hairless dog and named it James Carville. We are in this awkward interregnum that is unique to the United States right now, 77 days where we have a president and a president-elect that's a little bit like if you are getting married and you move in with your fiance and her soon-to-be ex-husband is still in the house. President-elect Obama met with President Bush. He was very graceful, and he said, there can only be one president at a time. President Bush said, that's not what Dick Cheney told me.
Aren't you one of the contestants at the annual political comedy?
Every once in a while. The Dow is down 400 points today. If we don't laugh, we'll be in big trouble, but it's actually a key point as well. In Capitol Hill, we're on the youth movement now. We've gone from the 91-year-old Robert Byrd to the young, vigorous 84-year-old Danny Inouye on the Appropriations Committee, and now we've gone from the old bull, 82-year-old John Dingell, to the 69-year-old young Turk, Henry Waxman, which I'm finding at my age, calling him the young Turk may make a lot of sense now, which does mean one thing in the health field, that there will continue to be generous funding for prostate research. But to cut to the chase, and there are many things to talk about, and one of the things I hope we'll get to a little bit is what role grant makers can play as we go through what's going to be a quick movement, but a never-ending process of changing this. And there are a number of areas, including, I think, what has not been done in a very long time, which is to look at Medicare and scrub a set of rules that are often absolutely crazy and not cost-effective in any fashion while also hurting a lot of people, and looking at access at least as much as we look at coverage. And there actually may be a negative correlation between expanding coverage and getting good access, and I think we need to get some real focus on how we provide better access to to people who, even if they have insurance, may not be able to take the kid in to get an ear infection checked out, because you lose a day at work if you have to do that. So many things there. But along the way, we know that at the early stages of this campaign, health and concerns about health were a major motivator. The sense that people have that has been building over many years that the safety net is just not there anymore. Stuff happens in the world and there's nothing to fall back on. Health and pensions is what led long before this meltdown, long before the earlier meltdown caused by the subprime mess and gasoline prices skyrocketing. When times were good, we had almost two-thirds of Americans saying we were off on the wrong track. So it was a motivator that moved a little bit further back as the larger and more immediate economic concerns took over. But all of that created a landscape that was extraordinarily favorable to a Democrat running for president this time, that led to this immense desire for change, which helped propel Barack Obama to a nomination, and John McCain for that matter, not the choices of their party establishments, and led to the not only robust victory for him, but the first time since Ronald Reagan that we've seen a president come in with coattails, with sizable gains in Congress. Just keep in mind as we go through this process now, though, that as Barack Obama looks at a House of Representatives that'll have somewhere in the range of 260 Democrats, a Senate with at least 58 and possibly one or two more, when Bill Clinton came in 1993 after 12 years of Republicans in the White House, he had 258 Democrats in the House and 58 in the Senate, and had a miserable 2 years that was capped by the meltdown of his own in the health care, the flame out of the health care plan. We have a continuing dysfunction in the political process that no one figure, even somebody as popular, dynamic, and awesome in many respects as Barack Obama is, can turn around overnight. What we do know is a couple of things, just to punctuate what Mary Agnes said. The first is that health is going to be a very high priority. Even if President-elect Obama didn't want to make it his top priority, Ted Kennedy is going to demand that it be a top priority, because he's not in a position at this point, after all these years of struggling and pushing, and from where he is, from his vantage point, the idea that you say, let's make a down payment now and then we'll come back to it in a year or two, is not going to be palatable. At the same time, the choice of Daschle, who is passionate about this issue, to head HHS, but not just to head HHS, even more significant and cleverly, to make him the point man in the transition on this and in the new administration, so he will not be undercut by people in the White House or other pretenders to the throne in an administration who can go around a secretary, makes it clear that this will be a priority. And if you have not read his book, I would go back very quickly and read his book. Also keep in mind that Daschle has been very active with other former majority leaders, including his law partner, Bob Dole, George Mitchell, and Bill Frist, at trying to find solutions in the middle, transcending the partisan divide in an organization, and health is a hot topic for them, and they're working together, even as you do find people in the Senate much more than in the House. Now, the money is an issue. We have always had a universal definition of health care reform. Health care reform is where I pay less. And when you come up with a plan, as the Clintons did, that said to 250 million Americans, you'll pay more so that the 37 million uninsured will pay less, it was a non-starter. How do you make everybody pay less without an enormous infusion of money when there isn't money? Just keep in mind that as the economy continues in a downward spiral, as we face the serious prospect of deflation, which is frightening, that I believe we will have a growing consensus for a new stimulus package that's going to be in the $500 to $800 billion range. We're not talking small potatoes now next year. It will be built around infrastructure, but the Wikipedia definition of infrastructure is going to be expanding every day to include many things that go beyond bridge repair, urban mass transit, buildings, highways, and the like. And health will be a significant part of that. This is the one time, at least for now, in an era where the first few months will be all stimulus, all the time, the Cialis period of governance, lasting more than 4 hours in this case, but not indefinitely. How do you get onto that train? And what we are going to see, I believe, is a several-stage process. The first stage is they will do the low-hanging fruit with money available in that package. That's going to include helping those people who are in serious trouble now, which means a bridge for the unemployed with health insurance, and it may include an expansion of Medicare to the 55 to 64-year-olds. It will include other things to help those where COBRA is not much of a help. If you've lost your job, you can't sell your house, and taking on that burden of the health insurance is not going to be feasible for an awful lot of people. It will include the expansion of SCHIP and maybe to include more than children at this point, too, possibly some of their parents, moving Medicare and Medicaid in an expansion out in the system. It will probably include the electronic medical records bill that has been sitting there for some time that has broad bipartisan support. Let's face it, part of the reason that it hasn't passed is it sounds absolutely wonderful until you then start to think about the privacy issues, but we're likely to see some movement in that direction. And then we're going to see not a clash over different concepts, but we're going to see an attempt to try and meld some of those concepts. Obama's plan, as he articulated it during the campaign, is really a variation of the Massachusetts plan, which has some good elements, but obviously Massachusetts is an easy place to try it, and it's already proving to be extraordinarily expensive. You have many fewer uninsured, many fewer illegal immigrants who are not eligible. You had a pot of federal money to use to begin with. But phasing in a plan of that sort using those principles is going to be the first thing on the table, and I think Ted Kennedy, who had a hand in that plan, is going to try and figure out a way to make that work. At the same time, Daschle's idea of creating a Federal Reserve in health to try and figure out a way to pull so many of these concepts together where you can bring efficiencies and cut costs even, is not mutually exclusive with that kind of a plan. You'll also see a lot of discussion over whether you can meld those two things with a plan that already has broad bipartisan support, with Ron Wyden and Bob Bennett being major players, which brings universal coverage. And with the Baucus plan, which we now believe was not just Max Baucus acting on his own, but part of a phase-in of ideas with Baucus followed by Kennedy and other players. And now the new role of Waxman, with President-elect Obama also making a very clear signal in his 60 Minutes interview, his communications with governors and elsewhere, that global warming was not just something he talked about in the campaign, but will be right at the top of the agenda, as will moving towards alternative energies. And, of course, we know that the automobile industry is going to be back on this agenda early on. How much time will Waxman be able to spend dealing with those things early on while also dealing with health? And how much do you want to take it out of what has, frankly, been a dysfunctional process in the Ways and Means Committee, with Pete Stark having his own very strong views expressed very strongly, with Chairman Rangel back in the saddle but having some questions of his own that he'll have to deal with, and with the leadership, I suspect, stepping in to play its own strong role. What we do know is this is going to be a top priority. While they'll do it in phases, the hope and expectation now is that at a time of crisis where you can move some things and where there will be some money, even if it's in the form of stimulus, is a time to act to try and gain something more. That it's not going to be done out of the White House dictating a plan, that Daschle, familiar obviously with the Senate, Rahm Emanuel, who knows the House intimately, and President and Vice President who understand Capitol Hill, are going to be trying to engage in a very interactive process over a period of time. Input from the outside becomes absolutely critical here, too. And any good ideas that can help them figure out a way to provide that universal definition of health care reform without spending a lot of money, and while looking at Medicare Advantage, but realizing that, among others, many in the Senate who come from rural areas are going to be saying, wait a minute, not so fast, that's the only access that we have, are not going to find it easy to squeeze that money simply out of insurers and pharmaceutical companies. So it's a great challenge, but also an enormous opportunity here for everybody in the audience.
Thank you, Norm.
One of the, can you hear me? It's fine. Okay. one of the advantages of sort of easing back into Washington is that I get to listen to smart people first and steal their ideas as if they were my own. I won't nearly be as funny as Norm or as informed as Mary. But a couple of things I do want to point out that sort of strike me from looking at Washington from afar, what I used to consider flyover country until I lived there for 8 years in Ohio. I think it's critical that whatever comes out of healthcare reform, we really should look at what kind of public backing, and Norm touched on this, the input from outside of Washington, is going to be very critical. And I think Obama and his team are very, very cognizant of that. I think that part of what they were doing with their campaign was sort of creating this net roots campaign where they were able to tap into people all across the country using new forms of technology, internet and mobile phones and all of that sort of way. They are building an army of people. And I think that army of supporters will be critical to whatever the policies that they plan to do in the first 100 days or the first year of the administration, and building sort of support for health care reform has to be a part of what they're doing, as much as being able to work the machinery of Washington to bring it about. So you wouldn't be surprised if any of you were wired in to the Obama campaign, that over the next 3 months, you're going to expect to get emails saying, get on board with health care reform, whatever the plans are. One of the things that that I wanted to sort of divest myself of, I'm not really an authority, so I can't say that I know what the shape or the contours of the health care program that ultimately will come about. I think we can be pretty sure that it won't be perfectly matched to what we've already heard that it would be through the campaign, simply because that was one voice. Once it gets to Washington, there are going to be 500 and some voices that will want to weigh in and have their fingerprints involved on it, which makes it even more important that you have this public support to build the case for health care reform. It's interesting to look at how that case might come about. It's interesting also to perhaps compare what Obama will be planning to do with how the Clinton administration attempted to bring health care reform about. A top-down, in the case of the Clinton situation, a top-down, held in secrecy, plan sort of sprang out onto the public and almost dead on arrival. I think we can pretty much be assured that that pattern will not be repeated. It will be a lot more transparent if it is to be successful, because it's going to have to get public buy-in. One of it's interesting to sort of look at, for example, in Ohio, and I did a little research to find out how people in Ohio look at healthcare as one of the issues that would determine whether that was how they would choose to vote for the presidency. In 2007, healthcare ranked only about 15% as a top issue. 18 months later, a month away from the election, healthcare had dropped to being only 6% of the issues that people in Ohio were concerned about as the important determining issue for them in voting. What happened? Well, clearly what happened was that the economy tanked. And as people became more uncertain about the economy, that was what they wanted the new incoming president and the new Congress to deal with. I think that presents an opportunity, and I think that's the reason Mary Agnes was saying that the lawmakers are beginning to sort of link the two together. I think there's a sense in the country that the economy is in crisis, and how the economy plays out in individual homes, in personal finances, right at the top of that is what happens if I get sick and I don't have health care. So that by linking the two together, there is a very good opportunity to be able to build public support for some kind of changed health care that will then put pressure on the lawmakers and the policymakers to influence that. I think that's also where outside groups have an opportunity to really interject themselves into the process, to sort of have become stakeholders in whatever is happening. Because there's going to be a lot of conversation and a lot of acronyms and alphabet soup that gets tossed around as people start talking about this, so that as it gets translated to around the dinner table or over the water cooler kinds of conversations, I think it's going to be very, very important that philanthropies and outside stakeholders have a role in helping to explain this to the larger public, because the larger public ultimately will be weighing in calls and perhaps even votes at some point about how this all gets shaped out. Money and timing, as Mary Agnes mentioned, I think really does hit the nail on the head. But I think the two of them sort of push each other or pull each other along. And the uncertainty about what is happening in the economy is going to be the driving force for change. And I think that fear, that uncertainty is what will make people say, yes, we will have to try something different. Now, what that different will ultimately be is yet to be revealed. But I think the public support from that will come from people sort of trying to figure out how to make sense of this in their own situation. One other person that you might, or one other historical figure that you might want to pay close scrutiny to as we look at the incoming administration, and there's a lot of comparisons, even Time magazine made it, to what FDR confronted, because you had a similar situation of economic uncertainty and the need to be able to build public support behind change, or radical change, in fact, really, really strong, different types of public policies, the likes of which we had never seen before, the country had never seen before, at the end of the Depression as FDR came into office. We heard the S word being talked about a lot, particularly out in the part of the country I just left, socialism. So that getting people over the fear of a much larger government role in something that heretofore had been sacrosanct as a personal and private issue, health care. There will be a much larger government role in health care, but there may be a demand for that. And how the Obama administration is able to articulate the need for that kind of change will be critical to whatever policy comes out, or whether that policy ultimately succeeds, which is another reason that I would say you really would want to sort of compare the differences between what happened in 92 when Clinton came in with his health care in 93 and how it didn't work because it didn't get the buy-in from a larger part of the public role. I'm going to stick a pin in it there and wait for the conversation.
Thank you, Sam.
Bob. Hi, can we hear in the back row? What I'm going to do is draw very briefly from a huge survey project that Kaiser, Network Exit Polls, Harris, ourselves, have been involved tracking voters over the election, to just give you a little bit of background. First, an important point to understand is there is a huge political polarization about what health reform means. Senator McCain's voters had a very different vision than Senator Obama's voters. So the reason why you have a one-time opportunity to go in one direction is because Senator Obama and the Senate and House so much reflect their voters rather than Senator McCain. Point number one. Point number two, health care for Obama's voters was a far behind second issue, but never left being a second issue all through the Democratic primary, all through the election. It's the distant second, but it never quit. Regardless of where they were Democrats, health care was the far-off second issue. The results show that there is an economic tie in that when you ask people what it was that they were hurting from the actual downturn, you thought they were going to start with mortgages first, and health care costs were number two. So in the economic downturn, it's not the aggregate problem. It turns out that, to no surprise, an employment-based system really leaves people in real trouble. The Obama voters, as distinct from McCain voters, thought that this election would lead to a big change in health care. So the team arrives with huge expectations of people who voted for Senator Obama that this was a big change year in healthcare. And that has real implications about what you can go back and tell people that there's no money left in the pot or something for that. So the I want to go through the beliefs. First, the healthcare cost issue was the thing people most worried about. But from an inside Washington, what you have to understand is that means helping me pay my bills, the personal side. There, we had a scale. Fixing the Medicare trust fund was so low, I needed to put another pair of glasses on. So I think it's very important. People in this town have taken this election, healthcare reform, to think this is the redo the Medicare trust fund election, not if you're in the tracking that we've been doing. The one, the uninsured issue, the majority of McCain voters do not want universal coverage. They told you 18 times, no. The majority of Obama voters really think that what he said and what Clinton and Edwards said is what they're going to get. They have anticipation. A lot of people are going to be covered. That's what they think is going to happen. On the system side, sorry, this was not an election among voters to replace us with Germany, Britain, Canada, or the Netherlands. It just was not. On a scale, people are unhappy, but they're not looking for an alternative, principally because the economy has five systems that are failing. So you had no focus on people's minds about the it of fixing it. It just is, I can't pay my bills. In the system, there is one big policy thing you have to understand, and it's really going to reflect the next 4 years. In the last 8 years, Bush voters said over and over again, individual responsibility. Individual responsibility. That's how we deal with coverage. That's how we deal with costs. That's what's really important. That's drove something called consumer driven. It turns out in the Obama voter, we can't find the word individual anywhere. And so the idea that the individual in the marketplace with their shield is going to take on the future of healthcare, it's going to disappear. It is not in any of the polls among Obama voters. It was all on the McCain voters. So there is going to be a change in the dialogue. And so what do Obama voters say? Government, employers, insurers, fix. That's how they describe the system. On the tax issue, and this is the one I got to leave you with because this is going to be the biggest single dilemma that you're going to have. Obama voters are really enthusiastic about taxing people who earn more than $250,000 a year. They really like that smell. They do not want their taxes increased to pay for health care. So if what we're talking about here is health care reform, which goes back to middle-income Obama voters and sends them a VAT tax, a schmat tax, a new tax, you are going to find a very difficult time about this. People are hurting, and these polls were done before the most recent downturn where people are complaining about paying for life's various things. A new tax is not an easy way to pay for life's necessities for that. So added to that, we gave them a big deficit, everything else. What are your priorities? First thing people would be interested to know, the top priority for both voters are helping veterans wounded in the Iraq War. The top priority. To no surprise, Obama voters want to spend more on everything else on the list. And McCain voters said, except for vets, no, no, no. So there was a big difference. They want to spend more. What's important is 6% of Obama voters wanted Medicare to spend less next year. And so it's important we have that dialogue to do this. Let me briefly deal with the economic downturn. And there are really just two issues here, and it relates to where it is. First is the effect of what has just happened is a reversal of the Reagan Revolution. When Reagan was elected the first time, inflation was the top issue. The A word was deregulation. Deregulation. The A word after Wall Street is re-regulation. That is going to change the environment for oversight of healthcare dramatically over the next 4 years. The idea of oversight over markets, rather than arguing about how it's going to ruin everything, is going to fit what people wanted done about Lehman Brothers. So there's going to be a whole different tone. But this is the critical issue about everything back to taxes. The worse it gets, the more people are not going to want to pay directly more to solve this problem. So the issue of the future is going to be whether or not we can jumpstart this without asking a lot from middle-income taxpayers. If we can, the climate is unbelievable for what has been discussed. If we are going to go back to middle-income taxpayers and tell them they got to pay a new set of taxes that they didn't pay last year, it's not going to be a good time, and you can see this right away on what people told you at the time of the election.
Thank you. Thank you all very, very much. I'm not quite sure I have all the questions I thought I would start out with because you answered so many of them already, but one thing none of you talked about, which I thought was very, very interesting, was special interest groups and what their role will be in this very large debate. As you all know, the hospital industry, the insurance industry, the unions, AARP, they all spend tens of millions of dollars on the subject of health care reform during the campaign. One of the unions said, we're going to continue running this like there is still a presidential campaign and drive this issue home. Where do the special interest groups get involved in this? What's their role? And where might the compromises have to come in?
Well, I think, first of all, some of them are going to be very important as facilitators, and AARP will play that role. I believe that the insurance industry is going to be in a very different place than it was in 1993. This is not going to be, we just need to get a bunch of Harry and Louise ads and then we can all make it all blow over again. Mm-hmm. They know, among other things, that issues like pre-existing conditions, that's gone for them. Medicare Advantage, they can get some changes, but it isn't going to be the world that existed before. What I do see is, I think, a pretty impressive effort on the part of AHIP, which is the largest organization of insurers, to try and get out in front of this with some of their own plans mm-hmm. and to work with the Democrats in Congress. Karen McNanny, who runs that association, is as sharp as any trade association executive as I have ever met. And a lot of the people who run insurance companies, and that includes people from, one end of the spectrum like George Halverson at Kaiser Permanente, the premier nonprofit, all the way over to the people who run WellPoint, they're smart enough to know that it's ridiculous for them to oppose major changes. It's how can they change along with the process. So they're going to be scapegoats. They're going to be pinatas. But I suspect we're going to see a very different dynamic than we had before, which makes it a little more hopeful that we can get something done. What remains important to realize is we still don't have a clue what will work out there. And we can look at some of these concepts, like the ones that go into requiring everybody to be insured. But you can have a concept and then try to apply it. First of all, it isn't necessarily going to work across every state. We're not going to change this completely where there is a national plan. And we don't know how we can manage the costs. And we certainly don't know how we can manage the cost when we know that there are no magic ways of taking a system that may soon move to one-fifth of the economy, filled with one-fifth of the people who are going to make damn sure that they're not the ones who are going to pay the price, and who have a mixed public and private system where you can always manipulate the process to get a little bit more and make it work. So even if we manage to find the perfect political process, it's not clear we have the answers either.
I think I did mention special interest. I just didn't call them as such when I made reference to how people in this room can influence the process. What the lobbyists and the trade groups and all of those guys will be doing will be trying to get the public on their side for whatever their particular piece of this will be. So I think that we're going to see a very healthy debate both inside and outside of Washington as they attempt to try to define what are the parameters of healthcare reform. So that you'll see, K Street getting involved. You'll also see, and their effort getting involved will be, I think, less important on Capitol Hill and more important out on Main Street, and sort of trying to get the ads, the Harry and Louise ads out to help shape what the public says they want or don't want in terms of healthcare.
To Norm's point yesterday, in the last few days, both AHIP and Blue Cross Blue Shield have come out and said, if you have an enforceable individual mandate, we'll cover those pre-existing medical conditions. Now, how that's all defined, there's an old saying, probably not just in Washington, everywhere else, the devil's in the details. Everybody's playing nice now. Everybody's getting out there saying, we want health care reform, we want to work with you. But when they start drafting that bill, if you see a provision, for example, that, you know, that deals with how drugs are reimbursed or how insurers are paid, all these individual things, that's when they'll really start getting in there and complaining and making noise. And as drafts leak out, as, you know, these things are starting to be formulated, that'll come down the line. But right now, Norm's absolutely right. They're all in a different place. It's much more positive, and they want to work together, and we just have to see how this plays out.
And in terms of the voices at the table, you mentioned some Senate Republicans.
Right.
What about House Republicans in this period of realignment of the grand old party? Who is there, and what are they saying?
Well, I think that they will talk a lot about being fiscally conservative. I mean, I think that that will be a big message. They'll say, yes, we want to expand health care, we want to be a part of this, but how do we do this in a fiscally responsible way? Now, there may be some political perils of that if the tide is going towards broader coverage, but I think that they're regrouping, they're trying to figure out where to go, and that will be the message that they will try, I think, to craft and carry through.
You know, this is one of those situations where it's going to look a little bit like the bailout bill did. You're going to find a lot of buy-in from Senate Republicans and a large number of them.
Mm-hmm.
Some more conservative, like Enzi. Some who, you know, to the average observer, Chuck Grassley is no raging liberal, but he's viewed by many conservatives as being more of a moderate. And you're going to get people like Bob Bennett. But on the House side, the process, I suspect, will be dominated by players like Paul Ryan, a very, very smart young guy, but somebody who's ardently free market. And they're going to draw some lines that are not going to be lines that Democrats will accept. And then it's going to be a question of whether the leadership decides to pick off the few remaining members of the problem-solving caucus, like Mike Castle, or to see if they can work out a different dialogue. Just one other point, Jack, getting to what Bob had said earlier. You know, when I say healthcare means health reform means that I pay less, it's not just money. It's also the opportunity costs that come with tremendous change. And Bob is absolutely right. We're not at a point where people are saying we're going under for the third time. Do anything. That's why Obama emphasized in the campaign, my plan says if you like what you got, you keep what you got. And that's also a very different approach than we saw in 1993-94. It makes it harder to demonize if you can make that case and make it credible.
Yeah.
Let me try to make a bottom line and very simple in my mind. We have the best political climate for doing something larger in my professional career. But there's one caveat. Everybody at the table has one word. It's called more. And more requires additional tax funds to make it work. As someone who's written about on the Massachusetts side, a word is thrown about and people don't understand. The idea that we require everybody to buy insurance does not lead to a riot, because in Massachusetts, most people get a subsidy from a taxpayer. If we actually did it like auto insurance, the governor would be hanging from an auto post somewhere. So when they talk about we all agree on that, not if you're going to ask people to pay $8,000 out of pocket to buy their plan. So to make a mandate work, it requires some amount of money, either from employers or individuals, so a lot of people can afford an $8,000 or $10,000 policy. That is the critical issue. If that is available, all these coalitions will come together, they will work out these problems, and we will see a very substantial bill. If that money isn't available, and I believe that's where the debate's going to be, is around the problem of the economy requires the money going somewhere else. And I have a very different view of Republicans. I believe their view back is to argue watching deficits really counts, not participating in expanding the deficit. So I think many of the Republicans who returned feel the bailout was a mistake and raising the deficit is a mistake. So signing on to a $50 or $70 billion bill, I think it's going to be incredibly hard for them to do. So the question is how many Democrats are willing to do this? But the critical issue is if there is no money, and we have to pay for it by getting it out of people now, the scale of what we do will be smaller. If we can find the revenue, Paul Krugman's view is we got to spend big to get out, then we are going to ease the process and something big will happen. So how they pay for it turns out to be significantly more important than what's in it. because if you're going to ask taxpayers to pay a lot, or let's get businesses to put up $4,000 a piece if they don't offer insurance while they're laying off their workers. I don't see that happening. So you're going to have to help them to make that happen. If they say they can help them, now we have something really big. Otherwise, we're going to have a small room full of what is actually going to be called health reform. That's the critical issue, is helping people financially through these years to start this plan.
I want to open this up to the audience in just a moment. And once I do, can you wait for the microphone to come to you? Stand up. Identify yourself so the folks at our web, who are watching it on the web, will know who you are. But, Bob, I wanted to ask you one question. Before this started, you and I were talking about this, about how difficult a political argument it becomes for some politicians to say we don't have money for health care when the American public has seen the money going out the door for Wall Street. And I understand now that there is some kind of deal with the auto industry.
That's an important thing. For people who work in town, there is a perception that we saved the economy, and this is a popular thing to do with people on Main Street. It turns out for a large number of people, it's a very unpopular thing to do. And we're going to have a real problem, not arguing the merits of what was done. If you say to Obama voters, we can't do anything in health care because we had to give money to all these other people, because they don't think that money should have been given to all those other people. So there's going to be an underlying political tension here. And also, I had this with college students and in focus groups. They say there's no money for health care. So what did they say to me? Blendon, where did they get the money for AIG? And I said, this is very complex. Very complex. very, very complex. I can't answer this. So, and they said, call me. Why can't we do health care with these corporate funds? So this is going to be a lot of political tension because people don't know where the $250 billion loan to the auto company just came from. So these are not going to be easy issues for people in public life once you surface them to actually work through in the next 6 months.
Is there a question from the audience?
Let me follow up on that. The Wall Street bailout was really interesting because it was a rare time when the politicians were actually looking at the numbers against the public.
Right.
And it's a question of whether would they be willing to do something like that again on healthcare, which the public is now saying they want. And that's a very good point. Good question.
Yes, sir.
Filerman, Georgetown. Do you hear any rising sentiment for a base closing act? Thinking ahead strategically, how are we going to get this baby through, up or down, base closing? Take it or leave it?
It's not going to happen with health care reform in the sense that we're talking about it. It could happen a little bit further down the road with Social Security and maybe even Medicare. There is a possibility that we'll end up with a commission that will actually have that kind of a dynamic. But it's not going to happen in this case, no.
No, I agree with that. I think it's too complicated, too many players, too many issues to put it in an up or down. I agree with that.
Okay, another question?
Yes, Dallas Salisbury. Just Mary Agnes mentioned that there were some key differences between what Baucus put out and what Obama had stated. And two of them you referred to. One is the individual mandate, which, particularly in the primaries, Obama was quite specific about his opposition to. The second was taxation of health benefits, which McCain pushed. Obama kicked back very strongly. Baucus mentions that. With those two things, how do you think those two key differences play vis-a-vis the administration?
I mean, I think that it will come down to this issue of do we have to pay for it and how do we have to pay for it. And I think that if you get a lot of pressure from Republicans and conservative Democrats that they want some funding there, they may look at, we talked about the Medicare Advantage payments, that's one, they may look at possibly limiting the tax exclusion. That could provide a little bit of money. But that's a really difficult place to go because employers really don't want you to mess around with the current tax system, treatment of health insurance benefits. They like the employer-based system. They want to maintain it. I think that people are a little nervous about capping the current deduction. They want to move very slowly and very carefully, but I think a lot of those issues will come up if there's an insistence about financing. and paying for it and showing how we can finance it. That's my guess.
In terms of the differences between different plans, Tom Daschle, in his book Critical, also lays out the plan with the Federal Reserve Board type organization overlaying the healthcare system. But he also calls for the individual mandate, which is something, of course, Obama does not. So what is, again, Daschle's potential appointment to HHS signal about that?
Well, my view is Senator Daschle was picked for commitment, ability to work on the Hill. I doubt if they had a policy discussion about all of it. I expect he said, I'm only doing this if we're going to do something big. So, but I wouldn't take any of those very big details. Writing about mandates, I'm sorry somebody's actually measured this in Massachusetts, requires money. And you will learn very, very quickly. You're for it. If I can subsidize people, you're going to be very worried about making a laid-off person buy an insurance policy without that. So this is a big issue. The big issue that are going to bother a lot of Senator Obama's economists and advisors is that he ran over and over again attacking moving any money out of the employer contribution tax thing. My experience is that the first year, winning presidents have a tough time if they ran ads saying no president has ever done this and I'll never do it, because the people who are opposed to this will rerun those McCain ads. And you will be sitting at home and he said, never will I do that. And then we have a quick deal and now we're moving money out. So I think that is a much tougher issue at the moment than the mandate. Obama actually said he'd mandate kids and he'd think about. You can think on the campaign trail, but you don't usually run ads as you did in swing states absolutely do it. So I think it's a problem because many of the people in the Senate side particularly are trying to find the money by limiting this deduction because it's less visible as one source of money. And I think there's going to be tension about this. And you can tell if nobody else runs that ad, Senator McCain will run that ad. Because he said, let's move the money out from there and spend it. And Obama said, no, nobody would ever do that. So I think this is going to be a problem the first year. After the first year, the people that I study have memory lapses. And so you have a lot more flexibility.
Where are we? Who are we?
Yes.
Yeah, question up here.
Yeah, I would say I don't think it's as big a problem. I think in both of these cases, what Baucus has done is, it's not exactly orchestrated, but it's close to it. It's laying out a marker of a mandate, and then we're moving towards a compromise, and I would be very surprised if Senator Kennedy's plan that he will put on the table will call for anything other than a phase-in over a significant period of time. And if you listen carefully to what Obama was saying, he was saying, we have an ultimate goal of getting everybody insured. I want to move in a slightly different way. In terms of the tax issue, if you tax gold-plated plans, and, you know, I don't care where you set the level, just as you're talking about whether you're going to tax people making over $250,000 or over $200,000, or how you define the middle class, if you say, I'm not going to let those auto company CEOs who took their individual private planes to Washington to call for more taxpayer money get away with having $50,000 that we're subsidizing for their health care plans, we're going to set a cap on what people can get, the rest of us subsidizing, and we'll use that to insure more poor people. I would say to Senator McCain, make my day, bring on the ads, and that's just what we'll see.
You know, we've been talking tonight about Tom Daschle for obvious reasons, but I'm also wondering if the person Obama picks to be Treasury Secretary is
yes.
as much a signal about what the administration can do in terms of spending on health care. Sam?
I think that we're getting ahead of it because the Treasury Secretary is going to have a really big job with the previous bailout. Yeah, sort of an understatement. And sort of trying to figure out how you pay for everything that they want to do. And the personality of that person and what their temperament is going to be in sort of pushing the administration's agenda and finding the way in which to do it, I think is a critical piece that we haven't even discussed yet.
But there will be money. We're going to inject money into the economy. We're not talking about how we divide up the $700 billion, much of which is going to AIG
or to other financial institutions, there will be another $500 billion or more out there. The only caveat here is whether we are so much engaged in triage over the next 6 months to keep the whole economy from going off the cliff and into the abyss that we can't devote the legislative or presidential resources to doing health care. If we do have the opportunity, then we're going to have $500 billion, some of which will be available in the short run to pay for what people want to deal with this problem.
This lady up here. Thank you for your patience.
Welcome. Dr. Blendon, you were talking about the Obama voters versus the McCain voters, and what seems to be coming out is some of their expectations or assumptions around health care, like they don't want to pay for it. So I'm curious if you did some polling around what they consider in terms of their health care, what kind of services they talk about, or what that might encompass.
An important thing these debates is to separate out people's concerns for their own health care and insurance from what they want the government to provide others. That is a very big difference. So people who have insurance want the best insurance they can, and one of the things they'll say to you is, I don't want my premiums raised, so I lose it. That's very different than, what am I going to do for the 47 million people? That's actually where the debate is. The 47 million people, and we polled on this all through 92 and 93 and everything else, that's what I am paying for somebody else to get insurance because they can't afford it. That's a different definition than what I want. So the answer, and Dallas here, Avery has done spectacular stuff. If people are forced to pay a lot of the premium, they settle for things that they don't want. So if America, if we had a dollar gas, Hummers would be surrounding this at the moment. At $4 gas, you're going to be having a smart car. So what we find is that people want everything in their package, but if their employer doesn't give them much and the state doesn't give them much, they have a huge deductible, it doesn't have mental health, they don't have this. So the economics actually drive how people behave. But the political debate is what I am willing to pay for somebody else, and that has been the problem in these prior debates. It starts out by what I want and my fears, and it ends up with somebody has to help 47 million people pay their premiums. And how much can I be asked to help at this time? So I think that's the dilemma of the debate. Not what individuals want, but what they are willing to get for helping other people who can't pay for it.
Yes, this gentleman up here.
Steve McConnell with the Atlantic Philanthropies. You have talked mainly about access and financing. What about the healthcare delivery side of it, quality? And a specific question about whether you mentioned, Bob, that nobody's interested among the public about that Medicare trust fund. But I think on the Hill, they're still looking at Medicare as a possible source of some financing, particularly if you could manage the chronic care issues better, save some money on hospitalization that might allow some additional revenues to expand access. Could you comment on that issue?
Mary Agnes? Well, I mean, I think that the Medicare that's been a question that's been raised. What role does Medicare have in overall reform? And I think they have to be looking at that. I mean, there's a lot of focus in Medicare on trying to deliver care in a smarter way. Like you said, chronic care is one focus. They've obviously been very focused on waste, fraud, and abuse. They're trying to, they just added electronic prescribing for Medicare, was in the most recent Medicare bill. So I think they're looking at all those elements. But I think a lot of this, you just have to remember, I mean, we all understand the complexities, but you've got, I mean, to Norm's point, if the economy, just keeping the economy alive trumps it, trumps everything, takes all their energy, then, you know, we may have a lot of smoke and no fire here on healthcare. I hate to say that as someone who's covered these things over and over again, but we could very well be in a position a year from now where all these things and all this momentum and all this mandate, if you will, that incoming President Barack Obama has and members of Congress have will result in nothing because they just can't swing it. But Medicare is definitely a part of that. I can't tell you exactly where it fits, but because the government accounts for about 40% of healthcare dollars. So there are a lot of people that say you can't really do healthcare reform unless you take a good hard look at Medicare. So I think it's in the mix, but I can't say exactly how that's going to play out.
Well, you touch on something a few of you talked about earlier, and that is that this is really all about timing and money. So let's talk about the timing piece of it. How quickly does the administration need to move on this issue to get something done? You talked about it being rolled out in several phases. But are we talking months? Does he need to propose something within the first 100 days to get something done?
Well, look, the timing, I think, is going to work this way. First, in that stimulus package, you're going to have a whole series of pieces. And one of the strategies that members of Congress will have is to step in and expand Medicare to a larger universe and expand Medicaid to a larger universe, partly because an awful lot of people would see as the solution just expanding Medicare and Medicaid to everybody who doesn't have adequate coverage. But that's the first step because it's an easy step to do. It's not easy to finance it, but now in the short run, it is because it's going to be coming from some of these additional funds. And then there'll be a few other pieces of low-hanging fruit. You're not going to have a White House plan that is a detailed plan in the same way that there was a Clinton plan. You're going to have a couple of detailed congressional plans, and those will be the templates, and they will be out there in the first 100 days, detailed as much as Baucus's plan is detailed. Then there will be a Kennedy plan. There may be a Dingell plan and or a Waxman plan, but then there will be a process over the first 6 months to try and pull actors together from both houses and from the administration with a lot of input from the outside groups to try and figure out a way to come up with some kind of a grand compromise. With that caveat that all of this, except for some of these short-term pieces, could be put off. There, by the way, is another reason for an urgency in some of these things. The really smart CEO at Aetna, who has gathered more data and looked at this, I think, more carefully than almost anybody else, at least in that industry, told me last week that they're finding drug utilization is dropping. It dropped by 20%. And they still, in the last couple of months, they don't know exactly why. But what's happening is a lot of people who don't have discretionary money are stopping the process of taking the drugs they need. So we're going to have a health crisis caused by the economic crisis. You've got people who aren't going to get treatment, not just for longer-term problems, but for serious immediate health needs, because they're weighing whether they're going to deal with heart palpitations or put food on the table. So I think triage in this field is going to be important as a part of an economic recovery.
Sam.
Before I contradict you, I wanted to know if you knew something I didn't about why you don't think that there will be a White House plan.
Because they're smart enough not to come up with a fully detailed plan that everybody else can pick apart. There will be concepts. There will be what the president put out. There will be some of the things that Tom Daschle will bring to the table. But they would prefer to have buy-in from Congress in both parties as they get their own input and set the parameters. I think it's just simply smart political strategy.
I'm not so sure if I buy that. I mean, I think that given the clarity of Obama's articulation of his health care plan, that there will be something that he'll attach his name to, if for no other reason to be able to say that he drove the bus that got health care. Now, whether that ultimately is the one that passes and in the wrangling, it ultimately prevails, I'm not so sure or certain about. But I do think that we should expect, clearly in the first 3 months, something that will be an Obama health plan that sort of has his fingerprints all over it that goes up to the Hill.
Bob?
I believe the politics are if the bill isn't enacted within the first year, it's actually may not happen the first term. And it's going to go like this. By the end of the first year, people who are thinking about reelection in the next year, who come from moderate districts where deficits matter. And if you look at the exit polls, what you discover is that Senator McCain split pretty evenly, and actually in some groups, people over age 40. And it turns out they come in off-year elections, and my excited college students don't always make off-year elections. And so people who are in more concerned districts are going to say, I'm afraid of a big deficit package year two. So I think all these things which tie to the economy have to be done by year one and you sign on. By year two, there's going to be a cautious crowd, and that may limit it. So I know nothing about the process here, but there should be a signing 12 months after he takes office, or your probabilities go down a bit. for that. And as somebody did a study about this, the history of we'll do it in our second term, there are a huge number of real big problems that were never done in anybody's second term. And so these are always tough bets about when you can get this done.
Yes, lady in red.
Hi, Lisa Miller from Maine. We keep talking about the high cost of health care, and really what we've been talking about is insurance. And we're not also talking about the real problem of spiraling medical care costs. And, you know, that's one of the buzzsaws, I think, that Massachusetts ran into. Is there any appetite in any of these plans in pairing health care cost control in some fashion with new insurance developments? Because if we don't pair those, we're going to keep having to pay more and more for health insurance and not controlling health care costs at all. We're just going to be in a horrible spiral forever, to me.
Well, I think that there's an assumption, though, that if some of these fixes are put in place, then that will fix the health care cost problem to some degree. But
right. I mean, that's the argument. You invest now. Okay. That's, well, you know what? The Congressional Budget Office is probably going to agree with you because CBO, as it's known here, scores the bills, right? And so CBO may very well say, I don't agree if you spend X on preventative health care, we'll get that savings over time, or health care information technology, or comparative effectiveness. But I think if you're talking about trying to place a cap or a limit on certain health care expenditures, that would just be a big non-starter, I think, politically.
Yeah, let me give you an example where I think we might do something. But again, recognize that cutting costs means cutting somebody's income. And you've got an awful lot of people who are going to be dedicated to making sure that it's somebody else's income, which is the way it's always worked. We shift the costs around in different ways. But I was talking to somebody who works, ironically, for a dialysis company, who was talking about a colleague of hers, a woman whose son had kidney failure. And she donated her kidney to her son. Son was unemployed. Medicare paid for the process, and then paid for the drug treatments that he had to get for 3 years, and then said, we don't pay anymore. So he had no job, he couldn't get it paid for, he let the kidney fail so he could go on dialysis because Medicare will pay dialysis indefinitely. Now this is insanity, and it's of course much more costly, plus it's a horrible thing to have happen. But when I talk to people on the ground in the field, they say there are a dozen rules like this that are just craziness, done, you know, by a group of people who aren't thinking about larger things. My guess is that Mark McClellan had his eye on really scrubbing this process, and you could save a lot of money over the long run when Part D came in and he had to spend all of his time doing that. There are places, I suspect, where there really are efficiencies here that you could build in, especially with chronic illnesses, and maybe you can find some savings there. But, you know, cutting those costs, the only thing that we've got going for us now is the unfortunate reality of deflation, which may bring all costs down, which has so many other elements of pain attached to it. Yeah. Let's hope that's not what we do.
Bob?
There's a long political debate that people with gray hair remember. Should you control the costs and then when it's all solved, you cover people? It turns out if you study Massachusetts, had they taken that, there would be no Massachusetts example in the presidential view. There are a group of things that there's actually a consensus to contain costs. Norm and others have listed them. I think they'll be packaged in a bill. But the answer is the coalitions that come together that will help Congress do this are not prepared to make some of the very difficult decisions that we do. And President Carter years ago decided that he would have an initiative which was national cost containment, and then I'm going to do the real thing. There was never a real thing. And so cost containment in a downturn is a very painful thing. So you have a group of things, pay for performance, quality measures, everybody agrees on it. They'll go in the package. But the really tough things have to be battled out later, and this political system is not as sophisticated to take on every issue simultaneously. That's a lesson learned from the Clinton plan. You can't solve it all in 1,700 pages. You can't. You got to spread that out over a period of time.
We're beginning.
question back there, and then I'm going to start to wrap
up. Hi, Crystal Haling with the Blue Shield of California Foundation. So it looks like AHIP may have turned a little bit of a corner, at least as I think they say, you know, they decided that if they weren't at the table, they'd be on the menu. So I think they've turned a little corner. But as we talk about some of the groups that really are incredibly important and critical, we sort of went through in California watching healthcare go down last year. One of the groups that's really important are the doctors. And I wonder, from your perspective, most people consider their doctor to be the best doctor ever. So now that, you know, AHIP is on one side, maybe we won't have a repeat of Harry and Louise, but, you know, maybe we'll have the revenge of Dr., you know, Marcus Welby or something. So how do we get the doctors? What's the, where do you think they'll be, and what do you think the critical issues are going to be for the doctors?
The critical issue, actually, with doctors is keeping them in the profession. So many of them are fleeing because they can't afford it. They're worried about their insurance as well. And that's I think it's going to be important to have them somewhere in the mix. And part of my thinking is you got to keep them engaged in practicing medicine. I haven't heard very much talk about that, but that's a very, you know, a very critical piece.
Well, I mean, they've had, now maybe this is a Washington-only campaign, I mean, they've had a major ad campaign to expand coverage for the uninsured, but I think a big issue for them is going to be what Medicare pays them.
Right.
And again, if this Medicare, the current Medicare physician payment that was crafted is going to expire at the end of next December, and if Congress doesn't act, they're going to have their physicians and Medicare will have their payments cut by about 20%. Well, we've seen that has never happened, but I'm sure that there will be lots of pressure on Congress to take those steps again, and that will be part of what physicians are, I mean, they obviously want to be taken care of in Medicare, but I think they'll be part of the debate they'll come into on the quality measures, pay for performance, or value-based purchasing, whatever you want to call it. I mean, and comparative effectiveness, I think they'll be at the table at all those things because every one of those is going to affect them.
Norm and Bob, could you take this question for one moment or two? And that is, how do the people in this audience become involved in a meaningful way in this debate? How do they contribute to it, either at the national level or back in their home communities?
Well, go ahead, Norm.
It gets to the point about doctors. There's one area here where it seems to me we really need to have a larger national focus. We do have a crisis with doctors. We know we've got a crisis with primary care doctors. But one of the things we ought to be focusing on is access to care. I don't mean access to coverage. And, you know, it is very difficult. My gut tells me that maybe having fewer primary care doctors is not such a bad thing if we expand the number of nurse practitioners, expand the number of accessible clinics, expand school nurses who can do preventive care, have mobile clinics, make them inexpensive and accessible, and move from there where you can get people who can do an initial set of diagnostics, especially as you can do it now even with advanced information technology, and then move right on to a specialist or a subspecialist if it's needed. That may be a blessing in disguise. Now, I'm not an expert in this area, but it sure seems to me that we need to focus not just on providing coverage, but how you get easily accessible treatment to single mothers who have to work all day, who do not have access to physicians, who can't say to a spouse, you take the half day off to take the kid to the pediatrician. How do we get preventive care for people who are under a gun every minute? How do we make it inexpensive so you can get somebody taking a look at an ear infection and not have to pay a fortune to do it? That looking at which kinds of professions we need to expand and which we may let just atrophy should be a part of this debate. It's not going to be something Congress puts up in the bill, but it really is something that you could do.
I want to deal with specifics about the foundation role here. What happened in 1992-93 is that members started going home and they didn't see a great deal of groundswell to pass that legislation. And they used to talk about the problem of the Washington scene. Every day groups were blowing by saying the nation's going to end unless you do this. But back in Kansas City, there were no such groups. What foundations that have local basis really need to work on, if you care about this issue, is creating forums so every single week some event goes on that makes people in Topeka and Kansas City and Dallas and everything else, this is really important. So when I fly home, I see people. Secondly, beneath the surface, there are huge differences between interest groups. You can bring people locally together to talk about the national debate to see if they can find it. Remember, national organizations are made up of local groups. They're not, there's not a dictatorship here. And so those decisions are decided by people back home. And what really worries me is we're going to have a lot of national attention, Kennedy says in this one, and then you're going to go home to these states. There's going to be nothing. And so that is a lesson, is that you should be able to fly in and know this is a big issue in your community. It's debated, it's in the newspaper, groups are meeting, they're discussing it, fund high schools to look at the plans and have debates about forums. Anything that does not allow the issue to disappear in your community is a huge contribution. They will not do it if there's not a big sound back home. And that requires a great deal of work. Otherwise, secretly, what a lot of us have been seeing is the organizations nationally don't have a lot of money. So they've been running ads on Washington Airport, CNN, you know, this bag. So it looks like if you're flying in and out, there's a lot. But back home, there's not a lot. And so that is a critical role for foundations to make this live back in their communities if something's actually going to happen here.
I really don't think that the Obama people are going to allow what you said to happen, given the way in which they have been so aggressive in their Netroot campaign. I don't think that was just for campaigning. I believe that is going to be a permanent feature of this administration on everything that they do.
That's crazy.
So that, that people, and I mentioned earlier, people will be getting emails and phone messages and phone text messages saying, tell your representative to support the Obama plan, which is the reason I believe that there will be an Obama plan. Because they've got this infrastructure, the likes of which we've never seen before. They're not about to let that go away. And they have to use it within the next year, because in 2 years, you won't be able to do it as well.
Yeah.
Once you get to the midterms, and you know, it's always a big reversal. They can't allow that net roots operation they have to atrophy without getting something forward in the next 12 months. You can tap into that too by being a player in that to sort of make sure that the people in the local communities are saying, sending a message back.
Is there one more question from the audience? We have time. This lady up here.
Thank you. My name is Justina Trott. I actually happen to be a primary care practicing internist in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And my question is, what do you think the likelihood is that workforce development in the healthcare sector at multiple levels, maybe multiple categories of practitioners, and maybe even creating some new ones, will be part of an economic stimulus package to create the infrastructure to deal with that onslaught of the 47 million who will have nobody to see?
That's a very interesting idea, and I'm not, I don't know. I don't know. I wonder if the main focus initially might be on trying to get people who are not covered, get them insurance, looking at SCHIP as an expansion, Medicare expansion. I don't know if it will go down that far, but to other people have just made this point, I think you ought to make your voice heard and say, look, while you're doing health care, why don't you take this initiative to broaden the physician workforce? It's an excellent idea.
Well, this has been an extraordinary conversation with truly wise men and women up here on the panel, and I'd like, don't clap yet. I'd like to ask each of them a question. We asked them to prepare some final thoughts, so you can offer us that. Or what you can do is give us your prediction. What are the chances that there will be a change in the status quo of the current healthcare system in the first year? Bob, we're going to start this way. So you go first.
High but not certain. But my point always is...
Highly uncertain?
No, high but not certain.
Okay.
But the point I want to make is sweeping events in history are driven by human beings. If the leadership is incredibly good, both within the government and outside. I'm absolutely convinced we can do something. But it really does matter. When you look back at the past failures, what human beings did really mattered. Leadership, wisdom, and how people run organizations, that will be critical here to the outcome. It's not just forces of history. It really matters how people do this.
Healthcare, I am not optimistic on. I'm somewhat pessimistic that we'll get the sweeping change. I don't think anything short of sweeping change is feasible, wanted, or desired. And I think that the events over the last month really make it all the more difficult. And I just think that the money problem is going to be so terribly insurmountable to be able to find a political solution that it makes me pessimistic that a year from now we'll still be talking about
it. I think the odds are better than even. I put them at around 60%, partly because you do have some really savvy players now. You've got a better climate by far than in 94. They've learned lessons from 94, and initial money will be there. This is not going to be the be-all and end-all change that's going to transform the system once and for all. Among other things, as we can see from Massachusetts, you've got a constant process of adjustment going on, and we're learning some things that work and some things that don't. Donna Shalala, who's very wise in these areas, I had a conversation with her a couple of weeks ago, and she said, you know, what we'll probably end up devolving down to is we're going to take some of these broader concepts and see a bunch of different states who have very different populations, very different cultures, begin to apply them, and then over a few years we'll see what best practices can work. And that's not a bad way in which to go. It gets back to Bob's point about what you can do at the local level. But I think it's not just going to be, all right, let's go out there and give states incentives to make things happen. We're going to go further than that. We are going to move in a direction that has principles that Obama talked about in play here. Whatever plan comes to Congress is going to be the Obama plan. And he's not going to care whether it's every jot and tittle of what his plan entailed. But there's a 60% chance, and I think it would be higher if it weren't for what we were talking about earlier, that we may be in such dire economic straits that there may be nothing else that can be done other than to keep us going into something worse than 1933.
I think a key thing here is, will we learn from history? Will we learn from all the healthcare debates in 1993-94? What are people willing to give? What are they not willing to give? It seems like it's the stars are aligned. It's about the best it's ever been, with the exception of the economy. That is a huge problem. But I mean, I went to this finance meeting yesterday, and they were really bullish. Even members who said when the bailout came out, Democrats who said, well, that's it for health care reform, all of a sudden have turned on a dime. Now, maybe it's a pep rally before the reality happens, but I think that if it's going to happen, it's going to happen soon. Will the Democrats hang together? How do they handle their differences? I think that's a key thing here, because that really hurt them in 93-94. And get your rest. Get some frozen meals in the freezer, because you're going to be busy. So that's my take on this.
That's the final word. It was a delight to have all of you here with us. Thank you.